Welcome to Storied Ground, a Northwest Ohio history podcast, where we enlist our region's many historical markers as our guides to rediscovering the presence of the past around us in all its wonder, diversity, and complexity. I'm your host, Nick Pavlik. If you happen to find yourself driving on Route 295 in Swanton Township near the Toledo Express Airport, you'll pass by an unassuming cement building with a square facade, set back a bit from the road and surrounded by open land. A red painted sign near the road announces the name of the property, Griffin's Hines Farm. So, you might think, that's kind of an odd looking farmhouse, but hey, just another farm in rural Northwest Ohio, right? Well, what if I told you that you actually just drove past the Hines Farm Blues Club, one of America's most legendary venues for blues music? Toledo isn't typically included among the important formative places in the history of American blues music, but in the mid-20th century, Toledo was one of the thriving epicenters for the blues in the Midwest, with shows happening nightly in the many blues clubs to be found on Door Street, one of the main thoroughfares for culture and commerce in Toledo's African-American community. But it was the Hines Farm Blues Club, located in the rural countryside outside the city, that would go on to become synonymous with the history of Toledo's unique blues scene, beloved by musicians and fans alike, not just as a venue for the blues, but as a haven for all sorts of community outdoor entertainment, especially for the African-American community. In this first episode of Storied Ground, the history of the legendary Hines Farm Blues Club.
All right, testing 1, 2, testing 1, 2. This is Dr. Matthew Donahue from the Department of Popular Culture at PGSU.
I knew of no one better to guide us through the history of Hines Farm than Dr. Matthew Donahue at Bowling Green State University.
I'm a longtime resident, creative, and native of Northwest Ohio. I'm a musician, artist, filmmaker, writer, educator in the field of popular culture. I'm currently a teaching professor for the Department of Popular Culture, where I teach a variety of courses related to popular music and popular culture. And I wrote a book called I'll Take You There, an oral and photographic history of the Hines Farm Blues Club. And I also did a documentary on the Hines Farm Blues Club that was in affiliation with WBGU-PBS.
Dr. Donahue's work helped revive interest in Hines Farm as an important site in Toledo's cultural heritage. And thanks in part to his work, Hines Farm was commemorated with an Ohio historical marker in the early 2000s. But just what is it about Hines Farm that has made it such a celebrated part of Toledo's blues history? To understand that, it'll help for us to take a quick crash course on the general history of the blues throughout the 20th century.
So just for a little background on the blues generally, how would you describe blues music and where did it initially come from?
Sure. Blues music developed in the Mississippi Delta region of the United States. It developed out of work songs sung by slaves, later sharecroppers. In some cases, blues lyrics focused in on the realities of life. The style had, lyrically and generally, sometimes it's called a call and response style. The earliest blues that was developed was known as country blues. It basically is acoustic in nature. So it was acoustic guitar with a mix of African rhythms and European ballads. And again, the Mississippi Delta region is sometimes referred to as kind of the early origin place of blues music. The style was developed by songsters, which are traveling musicians who basically played their own repertoire of songs. So it was sort of like folk music, if you will, with different songsters traveling throughout the different regions of the United States. And then the southern regions of the United States developed kind of distinct styles, you could say, to some degree. There's the Mississippi Delta region. Then there's the Piedmont region, which is from the East Coast, from Virginia down to the Carolinas, and then Texas as well. A lot of live performances for this early blues music took place at house parties and juke joints. And juke joints are basically drinking establishments. Often these juke joints would be built by an owner and basically in an out-of-the-way place. And it is still a popular entertainment venue today. From a recording point of view, records that featured blues music were often separated from white recording artists, to put it bluntly. These records were often referred to as race records.
One of the earliest race records featuring the blues was published by OK Records in November 1923 and included the song Goodbye Blues with vocalist Sarah Martin and guitarist Sylvester Weaver. It's a great early example of the blues' trademark call-and-response style. We have the call.
Now, honey, don't get mad at me if I should talk in my sleep.
Which is then repeated.
Oh, honey, don't get mad at me if I should talk in my sleep.
And then the response.
Even though I may say things that will cause you to weep.
With the advent of blues recordings, the blues began to grow in popularity beyond the American South. But it wasn't until blues musicians themselves began moving to northern cities during the Great Black Migration that the blues truly took root as a celebrated art form in northern African American communities.
And then we go into this period of the Great Black Migration, you know, the 1920s to the early 1960s, where we start to see the largest migration of African American people in the United States go from southern regions into northern urban centers. So places like Chicago, Kansas City, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Detroit, and of course, Toledo.
Due to racial segregation, at this point, blues music was still largely unknown outside African American culture, and blues musicians could only be seen live at certain venues, usually black-owned, that were welcoming of black artists and audiences. Collectively, these venues formed a network for live blues music across the eastern half of America that later came to be known as the Chitlin Circuit.
At this point, we move into this period of what was known as the Theater Owners and Booking Association, which was basically a network of clubs predominantly on the eastern half of the United States for black music. And a lot of these musical events then were promoted through black newspapers predominantly. Sometimes it's referred to as the Chitlin Circuit.
And as the Chitlin Circuit evolved, so did blues music itself.
For me, really, the interesting part of blues music as a guitar player kind of happens when the electric guitar is introduced into blues music. And this really took place late 1940s, early 1950s. And this is this period of what's known as city blues. A lot of folks point to kind of the three legends associated with the city blues style, Muddy Waters, B.B. King, John Lee Hooker. And what's fascinating about them is that they all started in this country blues style, playing acoustic-based blues on the acoustic guitar. And then they were also part of this Great Black Migration. They're all from Mississippi, but they moved northward.
The city blues style led to the development of distinct blues traditions in cities like Memphis, Chicago, and Detroit, supported by their own local recording industries.
And then you had a lot of independent record labels who began to record, produce, and distribute sound recordings by blues artists. And a lot of that was kind of a regional record label scene. So, for instance, in Chicago, there was Chess Records. In Memphis, there was Sun Records. And in Detroit, there was Fortune Records. And each one of those labels then would help to support their blues scene. So that's also important to note.
But by the 1950s, the blues finally began to seep into the American mainstream when it crossed over into an emerging musical style that had become popular among white audiences and that had, in fact, been greatly influenced by the blues. Rock and roll.
And then what we find is that basically by, say, you know, the mid-1950s and as we move into the 1960s, you find a lot of crossover between blues music and a lot of the emerging rock and roll artists of the time. So, for instance, like Elvis Presley would be a good example with his big hit, That's All Right Mama, which was originally written by Arthur Big Boy Crudup. But then Elvis did his own twist on it. And Elvis was a fan of country music and blues music. And you have people like Jerry Lee Lewis, a fan of country music and blues music. And he also incorporated that into what he was doing. And then also on the flip side of this, you have people like Chuck Berry, who was a fan of country music and blues music. You know, Maybelline could be a good example of this. Or Fats Domino would be a good example of someone who was a fan of country music and blues music and incorporated kind of this country drawl singing style in a tune like Blueberry Hill, for instance.
But ironically, it was because of rock and roll artists from outside the United States who openly celebrated their blues influences that white American audiences finally began to discover the preeminent black blues artists who had long been overlooked in American popular music.
Particularly during the British invasion era, you find that a lot of the artists also were fans of blues music and were doing their own kind of interpretations of rock and roll and in some cases incorporating blues music with that. And so we're talking about artists like, you know, the Animals or the Yardbirds or the Rolling Stones, who got their name from a Muddy Waters song called Rolling Stone. And then you found then a lot of these artists then often were featured in interviews, like, who's your favorite artist? And they'd say, oh, you know, we love Muddy Waters, or we love B.B. King, or we love John Lee Hooker. And then that led their fans also to kind of explore those artists. And so what we also see is that a lot of those British invasion artists then also came to America and performed a lot of these tunes, and also were doing these interviews, you know, expressing their love for blues music artists and so on. So what we find is then by the late 1960s, the hippie generation adopted blues music into what's often sometimes referred to as the psychedelic blues era. So you have artists like The Doors or Jimi Hendrix or Janis Joplin all incorporating blues music into what they were doing. And then as we go into the 1970s, we find a lot of hard rock artists also incorporated blues music into their music. So groups like Led Zeppelin or Aerosmith would be a good example. And even you could go into like something like some of the funk artists like Parliament and Funkadelic. They were also in their own way sort of incorporating this blues style. And then as we reach kind of the 1980s, we find that there was sort of a blues revival that took place in the country. A lot of this really goes to Stevie Ray Vaughan, the Texas guitar player, who basically put his own spin on blues music. And one thing that's fascinating is that, you know, Vaughan, like some of the artists that I've talked about previously, was doing these collaborations with blues artists. So he was performing with people like Albert King, or performing with people like B.B. King, or performing with people like Buddy Guy. And this kind of helped to lead this blues revival in the country that took place in the 1980s. And I think we're really still even feeling that today. A And this is something that's important to know, kind of going into this idea of how music can bring people together, and music is kind of a unifier of the people. So for instance, you know, even going back to the Rolling Stones, how there were some very famous recordings called the London Sessions, where members of the Rolling Stones would work with former blues artists and so on. So this tradition of, you know, rock artists and blues artists working together is kind of a long-standing tradition. I know everybody loves to talk about how things are divided and you know, oh, there was all this stealing of music going on. And I personally don't think that that is the case, because the people who are bringing that up, it's the critics. It's not the musicians. If you look at the musicians are unified. You look at a lot of different bands. Bands are integrated and have been integrated for decades.
The National Blues Revival of the 1980s also played out locally in cities across the country, including Toledo.
Back in the 80s, as part of that blues revival that was taking place in the country, that same thing was happening locally in terms of the Northwest Ohio area. And you have to give a big shout out to John Rockwood from Blue Suit Records, who was basically sort of leading the charge in terms of what was happening in Northwest Ohio, because he sort of single-handedly himself and others kind of in the music and cultural scene in Northwest Ohio helped to bring about this blues revival in Northwest Ohio, and in particular the Toledo area. And there were artists who were affiliated with Fortune Records, Art and Roman Griswold and Big Jack Reynolds and Blind Bobby Smith, who were all kind of a part of that whole scene in the Toledo area in the 1950s and 1960s, who were then kind of rediscovered in the 1980s.
I was lucky enough to get to speak with John Rockwood, a celebrated blues musician, radio DJ, writer, co-founder of Blue Suit Records, and renowned music photographer. Rockwood generously shared his memories of helping to lead the resurgence of the Toledo blues scene in the 1980s.
And a friend that was working at City Fest, and I was walking by one day, and I said, you know, how come you guys don't do a blues festival? She goes, well, come in here and we'll talk to you. So I went in, we talking, and they hired me and my partner, Bob Seaman, who later became the president of Blue Suit Records, to book a blues festival downtown. Then we did like 9 in a row or something like that. And I remember we were just getting Albert Collins, Dr. Ross, who was from Sun Records, and we had Big Jack, the Griswolds. I think Lazy Lester's on the show. Great stuff. All these guys all of a sudden were like playing in my backyard, you know, grassroots. It's pretty crazy. To read about them, you know, and then actually meet some of them, they were like legends, you know. Then we started booking them, so they got to know me, and we started doing numerous shows together.
Rockwood's lifelong passion for the blues began in his youth in the 1960s during the British invasion, when he picked up the first album by the Rolling Stones.
I got their first album and it had all these names on it I didn't recognize, you know. Jimmy Reed and Slim Harpo. I said, wow, what is this? You know, and then I never heard that music other than on the radio at 2 o'clock in the morning. We used to like slip in and get my dad's car keys, and the car was parked out back. Just turn the car on and listen, scan the radio for stations. And the AM stations really got powerful at the end of the day. FM radio wasn't really that big yet. So you could get Boston, you could get Memphis, you could get all these, you know, John R. shows. You know, if you, thinking back, we lived in a very black and white society, and it was racially charged back then, you know. They were just getting voter rights and all after the riots down south. So all that stuff, like, wasn't on the radio. It wasn't on TVs or any of that stuff. So it was really magical to turn on a radio station late at night and hear Lightnin' Hopkins or B.B. King. And so who are these guys? What's going on with this, you know? And then one of the first blues shows was Ann Arbor Blues Festival in 1969. I saw Sunhouse, Lightnin' Hopkins, Sam Lay, James Cotton. It was like, what? this is incredible, you know? And it was. But the whites didn't really know about it. I remember going to parties and I'd take a Moody Blues record off and I'd put it on like Freddie King Alive or Albert King Alive at Out West. And people go, what's that? I said, it's the blues, man. It's Freddie King, Albert King, you know? But then it started crossing over where we could actually find this stuff. And then it started happening. The blues started happening at campuses and on the radio and a college thing. I remember they had James Cotton at TU on the porch at the Student Union for 50 cents and all the beer you could drink. I was like, wow. And it was an incredible show, you know. The whole thing was like an awakening. Yeah, it was magical.
Through his work producing the annual Rock, Rhythm, and Blues Music Festival, Rockwood became friends with several local blues legends, including Big Jack Reynolds and Art and Roman Griswold. The band Rockwood played with, the Haircuts, became the regular backing band for Big Jack and the Griswolds whenever they played in Toledo.
My friend, who later was a drummer, was playing on the east side with Big Jack Reynolds. And I met Jack, and then we were doing this thing called the Chili Cook-Off at Westgate. It was all blues guys that we hired. We had Griswolds and Big Jack. And I knew the Griswolds, kind of knew of them, but I remember going up to Jack and I said, where have you been, man? He goes, I've been looking for you, Rockford. And I go, Rockford, what are you talking about? He never got it right. I think it's because he was always thinking of the TV show, Rockford and Son or whatever it was called. And so anyhow, I started hanging out with Big Jack and that led to us doing an album called Two Aces and a Jack. One side was the Griswolds, the other side was Big Jack, and it was backed by the Haircuts, a band I was hanging out with and playing with. Larry Gold, John Henry Newmark, Mark Gray, and myself would back the Griswolds or Big Jack or whoever was coming into the town. We hung out for probably 20 years together doing festivals and shows. And I remember we played the first time together. It was like on a Thanksgiving Eve and the place was packed. And it was like the first time we had played in a club together. It was all white kids and they went nuts. We had a good time. And it was kind of fascinating at the same time to even be on stage with these guys and play with them, you know. Couldn't believe that actually we were doing it in Toledo, Ohio. Not Chicago, not Louisiana or Memphis, Tennessee. That it was happening right here in Toledo.
How would you describe what Big Jack was like?
He was a character. I mean, he's a great musician. He couldn't read or write, but he could play piano and harmonica and guitar. He'd go, we're doing Funky Meatloaf. And I go, what are you talking about? Just do it. You know, we'd start playing and we'd have to jump in. You know? he was a really a talented guy. And I remember we had Ronnie Earl and the Broadcasters on the Blues Festival. And Jack was playing and Ronnie got up and took the guitar from Larry Gold. He was playing and Jack's going. And I go, what's up, man? He goes, I'm that guitar player, man. I want the old guy up here, Larry, you know. He didn't know who he was or care who he was, you know. It wasn't a blues guy that he knew.
How about the Griswolds?
Griswolds, Roman played piano, Art played guitar. Roman was more country and a great harmonica player, but he never really played it, you know. And Art was more like Freddie King, city blues, you know. And they were great. They had their own songs. They did Daddy Daddy, and they were big time. I remember the first time we had Art and Roman on the festival, they started playing Little Red Rooster, right? And about halfway through the song, Roman opened up his jacket and he threw a rooster out on the stage. He had a burlap rope around its neck. It really, it was showtime, you know, even in Toledo. They came from Alabama up to Toledo.
They ever talk to you about what made them stay in
Well,
the Toledo,
I know
Detroit?
I talked to Roman once. He said that that his mother had sent him up to get Art, because Art was playing with Big Jack in Cincinnati and Dayton, and he stayed, you know. So I think it was like the lure of the North and freedom and job-wise, you know. They kept him going, you know. They didn't have that opportunity in the South.
While Rockwood played a pivotal role in reviving the Toledo blues scene in the 1980s, Toledo had originally become a thriving center for the blues during the period spanning the 1940s to the 1960s, with many clubs along Door Street serving as routine stops for artists on the Chitlin' Circuit. But there was no venue in Toledo like the Hines Farm Blues Club.
So how did you first hear of the Hines Farm Blues Club in Toledo?
Sure. Well, I was an undergraduate student at the University of Toledo. I was taking a folklore class with Dr. Tom Barden. Again, big shout out to Tom Barden. And I was looking for a topic to write a paper on for the course. And Tom knew that I was a fan of music and of the Toledo scene and trying to bring exposure to the Toledo music scene, and was involved in the Toledo music scene. So Tom basically passed me a flyer for the Hines Farm Blues Club. And he said, hey, have you, you know, here's this cool place. And the interesting thing about that is that there was this folklore going on that the Hines Farm Blues Club had burned down and that it was no longer there. And so going back to what John Rockwood was doing, John Rockwood was bringing back these artists who used to play in the Toledo area in the 50s and 60s, and frankly in the 70s. They never stopped. Artists like Art and Roman Griswold or Big Jack Reynolds or Blind Bobby Smith, and they would play, and the haunting ground for a lot of those shows was Theo's in downtown Toledo. And so these artists would play at Theo's and other venues around the Toledo area, the original Ottawa Tavern. And, you know, I'd take a minute during their breaks doing their shows, and I'd, you know, hey, you know, did you play at Hines Farm Blues Club and all this? Oh, yeah, you know, it was the best place to play, and it was amazing, but it's burned down, and it's no longer there. And there was this kind of folklore that the place just wasn't around anymore. And I was like, well, that's really fascinating, because it seemed like kind of a place that was a little bit different and unique to the Toledo area. And so on this flyer were directions to the Hines Farm Blues Club. And I thought to myself, well, maybe the place burned down, no big deal. I'll just drive out there and just to see what's there. And I remember it was in the wintertime, I believe, and I drove out Airport Highway and eventually found myself on Route 295 where Hines Farm is located. And I'm driving down the road and suddenly, voila, there is the sign for the Hines Farm Blues Club in the distance. And then I'm driving and I'm at the sign and then voila, there is the Hines Farm Blues Club. And it was sort of unbelievable because, again, so many people had said that the place had burned down and that it wasn't around anymore, and then there it is. And I remember knocking on the door, and I think the first time around, nobody answered. And then I drove out there again, intrigued, like, what is going on with this place? And I knocked on the door, and the owner at that time, Henry Griffin, opened the door. And I would say in his own way, sort of opened the beginnings of the documenting of the history of the Hines Farm Blues Club. And, you know, he's, oh, hey, you know, what do you want? And I said, well, I've heard a lot about the Hines Farm Blues Club and, you know, how much of a great place it was and how amazing it was. And he, you know, told me some background and some history. And then I thought, well, that would be pretty amazing to document the history of this place.
Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of Heinz Farm as a blues club?
Well, this is a microcosm of what happened in the country nationally. So, as I mentioned, you have the Great Black Migration, and Detroit and Toledo were major stops for this migration with jobs available at auto plants. So there were numerous jobs available through the auto plants. The economy was booming at that time, and the music scene was kind of also booming at that time. So you have that period of the 1950s, and in which, as I mentioned, the whole city blues scene was kind of evolving and rising up and so on. And in Detroit and Toledo, there were numerous clubs in the city that were home to blues and rhythm and blues music. And in Detroit, there was Hastings Street, and in Toledo, there was Door Street. So this kind of thriving music scene was happening. And then what you had out of Detroit was Fortune Records, which, again, as I mentioned before, was an independent record label that basically was recording, producing, and distributing a lot of Detroit artists, but also Toledo artists. So John Lee Hooker originally recorded with Fortune Records. Bobo Jenkins, also, who performed at Heinz Farm and a number of other blues clubs in Toledo, recorded for Fortune Records. Eddie Kirkland also recorded for Fortune Records. And then, of course, well-known Toledo artists, Art and Roman Griswold and Big Jack Reynolds, all recorded for Fortune Records. So that's kind of the backdrop of what was happening musically. And then at the time, in the Swanton Spencer Sharples area, there was a company known as the Hallett Realty Company. And basically, the Hallett Realty Company owned a lot of land in the Swanton Spencer Sharples area. They could no longer pay the taxes on the land. They started to offer up the land into smaller plots, like 40-acre plots. And then word got out in Toledo's black community that this land was being offered up for sale. And African Americans in the Toledo area who wanted to get back into more of a rural environment started purchasing the land. And Frank and Sarah Hines were a couple that purchased land through the Hallett Realty Company. And originally they were farming on the land. And then they realized that there was an opportunity for entertainment to be had. And so they started putting on house parties in their home, in their basement. So people from the Toledo area would come out and just to be entertained. And then anecdotally from people I've interviewed, Sarah Hines was sort of the brains behind the operation. She was sort of like the super producer. And then her husband also was involved in a lot of this production and kind of vision as well. So they ended up building a juke joint on the property, and don't quote me on the date, but it was around 1950, which is very much similar to a lot of the juke joints that you would find that were part of the whole early blues scene in the Mississippi Delta region. And so then people would go out there to be entertained during the warmer seasons, and then they would move things back into the house during the colder seasons. And then, I think around 1957-ish, then they built a one-of-a-kind blues club, the Heinz Farm Blues Club. And a very large venue. It had living quarters for the musicians on tour up above. And then there was the live music venue on one side of the first floor. And then there was like a soul food kitchen on the other side on the first floor. And eventually they built an outdoor pavilion, which was originally known as Mr. Luke's Outdoor Pavilion. I believe that was built around 1961. And the grand opening of that was with Count Basie. And more people kept going out there to be entertained. They ended up doing a lot of, you know, radio promotion at WTOD. And then they would also put posters up on telephone poles in the Toledo area. And then one of the artists from Detroit, Big Gene Mitchell, he would also post these posters up in the Detroit area. And then there were ads run in Toledo's black-owned newspaper called the Bronze Raven.
Toledo Bronze Raven, September 1st, 1951. Heinz Farm 3-day picnic. If you like good old-fashioned barbecue and you love to go on picnics, and when the stars appear, you thrill with sheer delight of the opportunity to dance in the wide open spaces, I suggest you plan for you and your friends to enjoy just that at Heinz Farm. Toledo Bronze Raven, September 16th, 1961. Sparrow's Band coming. Among the many featured attractions coming to Heinz Farm will be Johnny Sparrow and his Bow and Arrows, featuring Terry Lee, who are making their first appearance out of the East in the Midwest. Mr. Luke, who is presenting the aggregation of musical stars, says there will be no admission charged on Wednesday, September 20th, and Thursday, September 21st. This great band will appear at Heinz Farm from Wednesday, September 20th, through Sunday, September 24th.
All of this kind of snowballed into this scene that was going on at this one-of-a-kind place, the Heinz Farm Blues Club. And then you had a lot of the major entertainers of the day also performing there. So again, people like John Lee Hooker, B.B. King, Count Basie, Little Lester Phillips, Jimmy Reed, all performing. And then the tie-in, they would often have local artists playing. So Art and Roman Griswold would be opening up, or Big Jack Reynolds would be opening up, or Curtis Grant and the House Rockers would be opening up. So that led to kind of more and more people just going out and being entertained. And the interesting thing about the Heinz Farm Blues Club at the time is that it not only catered to black patrons, but also white patrons and folks from the Mexican-American community in the Northwest Ohio region. So again, kind of going into this idea that music is sort of a unifier, a way to bring people together, mm-hmm. That's a good example.
And when Big Jack Reynolds or Art and Roman Griswold would play at Heinz Farm, John Rockwood and the Haircuts were there to back them up.
Do you remember the first time you played at Heinz Farm?
Yeah, I think I went out there, I was just hanging out, and I got to play with the Griswolds or somebody. It was like a resort area, because they had the main place, and they would cook barbecue. And then they had a place out back, I forget what they called it, but it was like a smaller venue, and the people would play out there. We talked to John Lee Hooker once about it. And I said, how is it to play out at Heinz Farm? He goes, oh man, Mrs. Heinz, the barbecue is the best in the world. He used to go out there on a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. He would spend the whole weekend out there, and he would play, you know.
Did you talk with Big Jack or the Griswolds about playing at Heinz Farm in the earlier decades and what that was like?
They loved it, you know, because it was wide open. It was like a big country picnic. And people there, for one reason, see them and listen to their blues. It's a magical place out there.
And Heinz Farm wasn't just a one-of-a-kind place for the blues in Toledo. Being located in the countryside enabled Sarah and Frank Heinz to turn their expansive property into a rural haven for community picnics, motorcycle races, baseball games, and a variety of other forms of outdoor entertainment.
And then they also had a number of other events to sort of attract people to the venue, particularly on the weekends. So in our region of the country, just like, you know, in all parts of the country, GIs were returning home from World War II. They still wanted to reconnect with a lot of their buddies from that era. They started forming motorcycle clubs in the Toledo area. There was the Atomic Pirates Motorcycle Club, which was run by Maddie Taylor and Art Taylor. And they were friends with Frank and Sarah Heinz. So they had this idea, because they had this large amount of land, to do motorcycle club events. And so they would do this kind of motorcycle races during the day, and then they'd have music performances in the evening. And then there were other aspects of outdoor entertainment, like members of the Black Baseball Leagues would put on baseball games out there. There was horse racing. They had like a little miniature golf thing set up. And I think that's what made Hines Farm unique, is it was located on 40 acres of land, because, you know, in the city of Toledo, the venues were smaller and kind of jammed up, and you're in an urban environment, a city environment. But then, you know, you could go out to Hines Farm and it would be like out in the country, and you could kind of stretch out. And so there was all of this kind of going on in terms of music and then other entertainment styles.
People liked it because when they moved up from the south, the land out there was real sandy, you know, and it reminded them of being down south on the farm country. That's what Griswold was telling me, that they loved to play out there because they could drink and get crazy and nobody would arrest them or anything. So one night they ran a car into a ditch out there. I said, what happened? He goes, nothing, man. We just couldn't get it out till the next day. And I said, anybody mess with you? He goes, no, just we're on our own. Magical times. But everything changes. That's one thing you realize, that nothing lasts forever.
The 1970s marked a period of relative decline, not just in the overall popularity of the blues in America, but also at Hines Farm, due to the ailing health of the aging Sarah and Frank Hines.
I think that part of what was going on musically is that musical tastes, I think, were changing, because, you know, now we're talking about, you know, the 60s, the mid-1960s, Motown had kind of hit. So that whole kind of Motown sound and soul music was running on all cylinders big time. And then by the late 1960s, you have this, you know, kind of psychedelic rock blues also coming in. And by the 1970s, you have funk music kind of coming in. So from a musical perspective, I think that blues maybe was put on the back burner, but not by all. But I think in terms of the popular music industry, blues music was sort of an afterthought. And then I think you get into the situation where Frank and Sarah Hines are getting older, and, you know, they no longer could run the club. And again, anecdotally speaking from interviews with folks, basically the club had deteriorated. And then Henry Griffin, he purchased the club, and then he took his own time and energy and money to sort of rehab the club. So props to him, because, you know, rather than turning it into a tourist trap, which he could have, he kept it very similar.
Did Henry Griffin, when you were meeting with him, did he talk with you about what compelled him to purchase Hines Farm?
From what I understand, basically he had such a good time as a kid growing up in the area that this was a place that meant a lot to him. And I think that that's the reason why he went in that direction.
Henry Griffin was the owner of Hines Farm during the period when John Rockwood played there. And Griffin's revival of the Hines Farm venue paralleled the revival of the Toledo blues scene. Rockwood has very fond memories of Henry Griffin.
I remember the harmonica player, he was playing out there, and I go, how do you like it? He goes, oh man, it was great. Henry took me on a tractor ride. And I go, you're kidding me. You know, he says, oh, he owns that, all that land back there. Henry's something else, because he did everything. And I remember, they go get our money, Rockford. And I go, well, man, the night's not over. And I go, go talk to him. So I went up and said, Henry, can you pay us? He goes, yeah. And he pulled the money out of his pocket and handed us to it. I thought, man, this is an honest guy, you know?
Yeah.
But after that, it was like, yeah, I can't pay you till the end of the night after we get all the money from drinks and stuff. Henry's a square guy.
In the early 2000s, Professor Tom Barden of the University of Toledo successfully petitioned to have Griffin's Heinz Farm Blues Club commemorated with an Ohio historical marker, which was sponsored by the Black Swamp Blues Society and the Ohio History Connection.
Tom Barden got it designated as an Ohio spot, you know.
Yeah, historical marker.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. You know, he got the marker. I don't know how it happened, but I took it out there, and Henry wanted nothing to do with it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't think he wanted the notoriety, you know. So I don't know if it ever got put in or not. It was on the side of the building for a long time, just leaning it up against it.
Oh.
The text of the historical marker is available on the website remarkableohio.org, maintained by the Ohio History Connection. The text of the marker reads,
"The Heinz Farm Blues Club started on this site in 1949 as a party in Frank and Sarah Heinz's basement. The club grew to become one of Ohio's premier blues and rhythm and blues venue until closing in 1976. A virtual who's who of African American artists played here, first in a picnic shelter in the woods and then in the main building, erected in 1956. Mr. Luke's Outdoor Pavilion, that doubled as a skating rink, was the last major addition, holding as many as 1,000 fans. Count Basie and his entire orchestra marked its opening with a performance under the stars in August 1961. Bobo Jenkins, Little Esther Phillips, B.B. King, Jimmy Reed, Buddy Lamp, and John Lee Hooker were among the musical greats who played Heinz Farm. Important local blues artists Big Jack Reynolds, Curtis Grant, and the Griswold Brothers were regulars as well. Heinz Farm also featured Negro League exhibition baseball, miniature golf, hay rides, motorcycle, and trick riding meets, horse racing, and three full kitchens that prepared regionally renowned food, especially the barbecue. When the Heinz became ill in the mid-1970s, the club closed and remained unused until Henry Griffin purchased it in 1978. Griffin, who was raised in nearby Swanton, had fond memories of Heinz Farm and brought it to renovate the club, now known as Griffin Heinz Farm. It has reemerged as a lively music venue in the 21st century while preserving the atmosphere of the early age when it was the undisputed center of the blues in Northwest Ohio in the predominantly black rural area called Spencer Sharples. A major stop on the Chitlin Circuit, a painted sign by the shelter still urges patrons to do as Cool and the Gang says, celebrate good times, come on.
John Rockwood will always celebrate those good times, even if that celebration is tinged with loss.
It was just an experience, like it was like a young guy running away with the circus, you know. I didn't know what it was, but I wanted to be part of it, and I did. I was lucky. It's all gone now. I don't think most of the guys who passed on or aren't playing anymore. And the enthusiasm back in the 60s for the blues is gone. That isn't happening anymore. It's not going to happen. Days. You know, when you're doing it, you think there's no end to it, but there really is an end to it. Nothing lasts forever, it's true. But what a journey, huh?
Henry Griffin passed away in 2013. But Griffin's Heinz Farm remains in operation today, under different management, and stands as an enduring testament to an unforgettable period in Toledo history when the Glass City really had the blues.
The history of Heinz Farm Blues Club, it's kind of timeless, and even the documentary is kind of timeless, and it captures kind of a neat era in history, which, quite frankly, probably would have gone forgotten. I have to be honest, I'm not tooting my own horn, but certainly the book and the documentary kind of led to this historical revival and or knowledge of the Heinz Farm Blues Club. But that being said, I have to give a big shout out to, you know, the late great Art and Roman Griswold and Big Jack Reynolds, and all the folks who assisted me, who were very kind and loving with their valuable time to meet with me and just be so amazing and cool with their time and sharing the history. And again, it just also kind of highlights this whole idea that, oh, everybody's divided and there's all this conflict between people and so on. And look, those dudes were totally open and inviting and shared with me so much. And without all of the players involved in, you know, behind the scenes, if you will, whom I interviewed and so on, that history also would never have come up.
And for those interested in learning more about the history of the one-of-a-kind Hinds Farm Blues Club.
My book is still available. It's called I'll Take You There, an Oral and Photographic History of the Hinds Farm Blues Club. I would strongly encourage folks to contact their local PBS affiliate to air the documentary, The Hinds Farm Blues Club. And all they have to do is get in touch with the folks at WBGU PBS to get that documentary. And I think just really importantly, going back to what I've talked about before in terms of blues music and the Hinds Farm Blues Club, is just this whole idea how music is a unifier, and music and music establishments can bring people together, and it's the critics who usually get it wrong. And basically, the critics love creating drama and controversy and division. But if you look at the musicians and what they're doing, they're coming together. So I would say follow the musicians' lead and see examples in history, like members of the Rolling Stones working with Sonny Boy Williamson, for instance, or Eric Clapton and B.B. King collaborating together, or, I mean, dare I say it, Matt Donahue and Skip Little Axe McDonald collaborating together, or Frank and Sarah Hinds being open to having all colors and creeds to Hinds Farm to be entertained. And that is an awesome way that we can overcome a lot of the division that is being hyped up. Because if you look at the examples in history and what's really going on, particularly amongst the creative people, they are united and they are not divided.
Thanks to Dr. Matthew Donahue and John Rockwood, our guests for this episode of Storied Ground.
Our voice actor was Danny K. Ellis.
I'm your host and producer, Nick Pavlik. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. If you have any questions, comments, or you want to listen again, go to wgte.org/ground or wherever you stream your podcasts.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners and administered by the Arts Commission.